We've had a war on terror since October 2001. Are we less terrified now? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Afghanistan was attacked shortly after 9/11. Iraq invaded in 2003. Soon, a young Alaska journalist came on Talk of Alaska to tell what he had seen in Iraq. Dar Jamil is back and on the show again today. You can call at 1-800-478-8255, toll-free. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk at aprn.org. Dar Jamil will be appearing in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau, and with us now on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Penn Air, providing scheduled service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations online at pennair.com. And by BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future.
Okay, well, it's great to have Dar Jamil back on the program. He's with us by telephone because he is touring and promoting his new book, which is entitled The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. He will be in Alaska in next week on the 16th. He will be at the University of Alaska Anchorage Social Science Building, room 118 at 7 p.m. and also is booked in Fairbanks and Juneau, but I do not have particulars on those parts of the tour, and there will probably be callers who will know. We had Dar Jamil on quite a long time ago, as I mentioned in the introduction of the show. He had been in Iraq, I think, once or twice at that time, and it was a fascinating story that he told. He subsequently published a book, Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. Dar Jamil, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thanks, Steve. Great to be with you again.
Yeah, we've actually even stood on the same in front of the same crowd a couple of times. I think I emceed at least once when you came up here and spoke. So it's great to talk with you once again.
Likewise.
I think where I want to go right away, beyond the Green Zone, is a place called Fallujah, because I don't think that had happened when you were on the show before. That was lying in your future. But what an incredible episode that was for any young journalist to be this savage attack, oddly reported, and oddly, I guess, would be the best word to reported in the fragmentarily and oddly and from one point of view, reported in the mainstream media, and you actually get in touch with people in Fallujah and bring an entirely different story. What was that like? What sent you to Fallujah?
Fallujah really was a microcosm of the entire invasion and occupation of Iraq. It was a situation where the siege of the city was sold to the American people as, well, the U.S. has to go in and destroy this city because there's this guy called Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, a Jordanian terrorist, who basically had taken the city hostage. That's how it was sold propagandistically to the American people. And, you know, thanks in large part to the corporate media, most folks bought it. But the reality was Fallujah was a situation where, you know, most people there in the city welcomed the U.S. in when the country was invaded. There was no fighting in Fallujah whatsoever, but problems began shortly thereafter when Americans occupied a school. People protested. They wanted the school for their kids. Americans ended up killing 17 demonstrators. This was in late April 2003, about 2 weeks after the fall of Baghdad. 3 weeks, I'm sorry. And so the resistance, that basically sparked off a resistance in Fallujah, and it grew, and it got out of control to the point where Americans couldn't patrol the city anymore without being attacked every time they tried to run a patrol. So in April of 2004, there was a giant attack on the city, and I managed to get inside the city, going in on a bus carrying humanitarian supplies to a small clinic inside the city, and report on the use of cluster bombs and flechettes and other types of restricted munitions, as well as really the rampant targeting of the civilian population. And of course, when I reported that at the time, I caught a lot of flack from everywhere across the political spectrum because people didn't want to consider the fact that the U.S. military would behave in such a matter. Of course, I retorted in saying, well, this is war. This is what happens when war happens, is these types of terrible things occur. Since that time, Many American soldiers themselves who took part in that siege, as well as the latter one in November of the same year, have come out and told me and other journalists directly, yes, this is exactly what we did. We targeted ambulances. We targeted civilians. We used force very indiscriminately. The entire city was declared a free fire zone. And I think, you know, then following that siege in November of that same year of 2004, there was the second much, much more massive siege that largely destroyed the city. And then I went back into Fallujah actually earlier this year and spent a night in there and toured around the city a bit. And it was amazing to see in February of 2009, just about 5 years after this, the whole city was just about completely destroyed. There's been almost no reconstruction whatsoever. So again, it's a microcosm of the situation in Iraq as a whole.
Well, when you would send your dispatches out, and they would run in various alternate media outlets, pretty much, and I guess really still are. You really stuck to what you personally had seen, or experienced. Or found out about, which kind of distinct from what the rest of the media was saying. So I guess that sort of helped you develop a following. Why did you take that path?
Well, basically because it was the only way to operate as an independent journalist and write about what I was actually seeing and not be censored or not have an editor that would try to tell me, well, write about it from this angle or spin it this way. That consistently the only outlets I found that would let me report completely accurately as things were happening on the ground were either in the alternative media in this country or in some of the overseas outlets. And interestingly enough, it's been kind of over the years a schizophrenic experience for me because, you know, here in the U.S. I'm largely limited to alternative media. There's only been a couple of very, very brief exceptions of a few minutes on NPR National, where I've actually had some broader exposure, but mostly it's been alternative or independent media outlets here. But then I go overseas and I'm on the BBC or basically any country I go to, if I'm giving a talk or on a book tour over there, I'm on national TV, national radio, national newspapers, every country I go to. So it's pretty interesting where what's considered alternative media here in the U.S., at least in Western Europe, is considered fairly mainstream.
Well, your analysis from the beginning, I think, and history is bearing this out, is that the U.S., or I guess we would call it the coalition, really, couldn't keep from taking sides in what essentially is a longstanding civil dispute. In other words... They had to take sides.
They did very, very intentionally. And basically, it's very, very simple. We can boil it down like this. Saddam Hussein was the U.S.'s man. A CIA orchestrated coup brought him into a position of power in 1968. Just a few short years after that, he was able to roll into the position of dictator of the country. He was supported there by the U.S. through all of his worst atrocities, through most of his mass killings. He had unbridled U.S. support through the Reagan administration, through of course, even during the Clinton administration, through the sanctions, he was still being left in power. Then, of course, when he fell out of favor, back in 1990 when he invaded Kuwait, he then kind of started to become the bad guy, and the U.S. started trying to figure out a way, okay, how can we support someone else in that country that's going to much more willingly do our bidding. And so Saddam Hussein has basically been replaced with a guy named Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. He's the current Prime Minister of Iraq. This was a guy who was inserted in that position. I was in Baghdad for the January 30, 2005 elections, and a cabinet was brought into power, parliament, and under their system of government, the parliament then decided to choose who was going to be the prime minister, and they did. They chose a guy named Ibrahim al-Jaafari. Well, he wasn't exactly towing the U.S.-UK line, so then Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld, he sent Condoleezza Rice over, the then Secretary of State, and her UK counterpart, Jack Straw, visited Baghdad. And then just as they were leaving, the day they left Baghdad, Ibrahim al-Jafari was moved out of prime minister position, and they inserted Nouri al-Maliki. So there was no democracy involved whatsoever in this process. And he's basically now the Shia Saddam. They've reconstituted Saddam's Mukhabarat, the intelligence services, which was basically the glue to his dictatorship. And but we now have a Shia Saddam in Baghdad, and we have a massive security force under his direction. And of course, it's basically been the Sunnis being replaced by the Shia. So the U.S. basically just changed sides.
Meanwhile, across the border, of course, you've got the Kurds, but then you've got Iran, and that is also a Shia regime. So how come they're still unfriendly with one another?
Well, this is what's very interesting is the U.S., and this is fairly well documented, in that the U.S. plan was to install a pro-U.S. secular Shia regime in Iraq, and in that way it would be opposed to the Shia regime in Tehran, which is anything but secular. I mean, it is a theocracy in Tehran, in their next door neighboring state of Iran. So the U.S. plan was, we're going to prop up this pro-U.S. secular regime in Baghdad that will be at odds with that in Tehran. But interestingly enough, again, from the beginning of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, we've been able to say this, the U.S. has been playing checkers while others in the Middle East have been playing chess. And so it's funny, and the great irony is the U.S. appoints this guy, Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, as Prime Minister of Iraq, yet Maliki was head of the Dawa Party, a religious party started in Tehran, Iran. Maliki was in exile in Tehran for 8 years during the regime of Saddam Hussein. So this is a guy who's very, very clearly has had and has strong ties to Tehran, and yet it's the U.S. who puts him in the most powerful position in Baghdad. And then they wonder, well, why is Nouri al-Maliki signing these contracts with Tehran? Why is he making visits to Tehran? Why is he being very pro-Iranian? And it's kind of the joke is on us, and well, it's the U.S. who put him in that position in the first place.
Wow. So now we have a new administration, which is basically trying to take the stress off of Iraq and place it instead, the emphasis on Afghanistan. Have you had any experience in Afghanistan?
I have not reported from Afghanistan, no. I've basically been, of course, following the situation and have many of journalist friends who are working over there and have been for a long time. But I have been tracking it from the aspect of, you know, really more the current topic of my recent book about what's happening in the U.S. military as a result of both occupations. So I have been talking to a lot of soldiers who have been coming back from both Iraq and Afghanistan, and what's happening, we're looking at this breakdown in the military that is so overstretched at this point with both occupations and people coming back from Afghanistan. But certainly looking at it from a kind of larger political game context, the way the U.S. government looks at it, where they even refer to Afghanistan now as AFPAC, as in Afghanistan, Pakistan, as the theater, and not just as Afghanistan, I think is indicative of really how out of control the situation is spiraling. And here we are, as we speak, on the brink of an Obama administration that is looking at sending as many as 45,000 more troops into Afghanistan. And so I think the question that will follow once they announce this next troop surge, whether it's 10,000 or 30,000 or 40,000 or whatever it's going to be, is where are they going to find these troops? Because we're in a position right now where the military is so extremely overstretched, and even with a big recruiting year this year because of the massive economic downturn, they still just don't have enough troops for both these occupations. Because we have to keep in mind that while Iraq has fallen out of the headlines, there's still a minimum of 124,000 U.S. military personnel in that country. We're not seeing any big dramatic decreases, at least not yet. And Afghanistan, we have 69,000 Americans, and there will be as many as over 100,000 by the end of next year if current trends continue.
Our guest is Dar Jamail. He is author of The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. And your phone calls are welcome. It's 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, and a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk at aprn.org. Dar Jamail has been on Talk of Alaska before, earlier in his coverage of events in Iraq. He's moved on to concentrate on the composition of the U.S. military, and he'll be coming to Alaska next week, speaking at Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, possibly elsewhere. The Will to Resist, Dar Jamail. You know, I was actually sitting with some former Anchorage police officers who had gone from the military to the police force, retired out of the police, went into the National Guard, and have now repeatedly seen active duty in Iraq. And these two guys were just talking about how it is. And one said to the other, he said, well, what do you do about those Hummers? And he says, well, we either blow them or we tow them. And he was talking about that these not well armored vehicles, when they are disabled, how they deal with them. And he says, well, we either blow them up so the other side doesn't get them, or else we tow them. And it just led this kind of picture to me. I mean, both these guys are beyond retirement age, and they're both like providing mentorship to young people going into combat. And this picture of these gray-haired guys and these limping Hummers, some of them being towed by other ones, just really sticks with me through the desert. And you're now telling me that that's what we're getting. We're getting kind of an outland military without realizing it.
It's true. I mean, and that's an important point, Steve, because that's when I started running in and hearing, running into these stories about kind of breakdown in the military and dissent and why is morale as low as it is in the military regarding both these occupations. One of the first reasons I heard, and this is old news, I mean, we were hearing this early on in the occupation. Of course, Don Rumsfeld even had to go over to Iraq and try to quell a little bit of the unrest and frustration that was happening when people were complaining in the military, and rightly so, that, hey, we don't have body armor. We're being sent over without night vision goggles. We have these Humvees. And I talked to a guy named Eli Wright, a soldier, and he said, look, we were over there going through scrap heaps at our base, at our forward operating base, trying to find hunks of metal and bolt them onto our Humvee doors because we didn't have armor. We were doing things like putting sandbags in the floor, hopefully garnering some form of protection in case we ran over a roadside bomb. And this was very, very commonplace. I talked to people who were consistently being put in positions to do things that they were not trained to do. They were not in their job description, but they were literally being sent out on patrols when they were supposed to be working as a mechanic, this type of thing. And then, in addition to that, giving equipment that just wasn't up for the task. And so this is why I started hearing things like people would say, look, we decided that we were opposed to the mission. There was no clear vision of what is victory, what does it look like when we succeed, this kind of thing. And so I started meeting people who were telling me they were doing things called search and avoid missions, which is kind of a play on the search and destroy moniker.
Yeah.
And this is not new. This was very rampant during Vietnam. But I met a guy named Phil Aliff who said, look, we would go out, rather than driving around waiting to get blown up, kind of like what your fellow was just telling you, you mentioned he had told you, is that he said, look, we got tired of playing the IED lottery, the improvised explosive device lottery, which was just basically driving around wondering if this was going to be our day that we got blown up. So we decided to start driving out to the end of our patrol routes, parking our Humvees in a big, wide-open field, ideally under some date palms, smoking cigarettes, listening to our iPods, drinking sodas and pretending, and phoning in the base every hour and say, yep, we're still searching the field for weapons caches. And it really surprised me. I had never heard of this before. I didn't know that they could pull this kind of thing off and get away with it. But then I kept running into more and more veterans, I was hearing similar stories. In some instances, hearing almost the exact same story, but from a different location in Iraq, from a completely different time period of the occupation. And so I decided to start pursuing the story and learning things like that were very rampant. Other kinds of resistance in accord accordance with different types of problems within the military, whether it was resistance against the cases of sexual assault in the military. For example, I didn't know before I started investigating all these stories that, according to the Veterans Administration, one out of three women seen by the Veterans Administration admit to having been sexually assaulted during their tenure of the military. So this is very, very staggering information that I was coming across. And then other things, like on an average year in the military, since 2001, where we've seen anywhere from between 4 and 12,000 troops go absent without leave every single year.
Dar Jamil is our guest. It's 1-800-478-8255. Always a fascinating conversation when we get Dar on the radio, and he'll be in Alaska later on this month and available to talk to audiences. Probably be some kind of tie-in with the book. He's on a book tour for his book, which is, well, you're hearing the subject, Soldiers Who Refused to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. We just really, Dar, haven't heard this story very much. I'm kind of surprised. I'm just kind of surprised. I mean, there's been, you know, we heard a little bit about the armor stuff. We've heard there's been some pretty good investigative reporting on how VA might not be handling the medical problems people are turning up with very well. Very, very stingy with any kind of disability ruling. But what you're telling me is in a completely other scale. So this is going to be a fascinating book to read. How long has it been out?
It came out in early July, and really we've just been doing a bit more media with it and getting it a bit more attention in fall once school got back in session, since that's where most of my talks have occurred, is on universities. But it's really, you know, this amount of dissent in the military is really surprising to people until they start hearing more and more of the context. And some of it is what we've talked about. And you just touched on, I think, what I think is really one of the core issues of why there are big problems in the military today. And it's that people in the military are not being taken care of. And I'm gonna give you a few more statistics that are going to show this, and these are all from the Veterans Administration. So these are statistics coming straight from the VA. For example, 18 veterans a day in this country kill themselves. 18 veterans a day from all wars, not just Iraq and Afghanistan. 1,000 veterans a month that are technically under the auspices of VA care attempt suicide. More veterans are killing themselves daily in this country than are being killed in open combat overseas every single day. And this is a result of the fact that the VA, and this happened under the Bush administration, and we're seeing a continuing trend into the Obama administration, is consistently underfunded, understaffed, and either unable or unwilling at times to give these folks the care they need when they come back. We had a RAND Corporation survey that came out last year. This is a military-linked think tank. And this survey showed us that at the time, of the 1.8 million veterans who had been cycled through Iraq and Afghanistan, now that number is over 2 million. But at the time of the 1.8 million, 300,000 have come home diagnosed with severe post-traumatic stress disorder or severe depression. So then these people enter a VA system where the average length of time that someone has to wait to get help at the VA is 6 months. And then if they file a disability claim with the VA and that claim is denied and they appeal that claim, the average wait for their appeal is 4.5 years. So then what are these folks with severe PTSD that can't sleep, they're having nightmares, they're self-medicating with drugs and alcohol, what do these people do to get help? And then that's when we hear these shockingly high suicide statistics. They're not so shocking, because this is how bad the system is, how under-equipped the VA is to deal with the massive level of people coming back home broken from both these ongoing endless occupations. So this is a real crisis situation, and so how the military is responding to it is they're doing things like sending 43,000 troops so far back into both occupations who have already been medically listed as undeployable. I spoke with a guy, actually, briefly up in Fairbanks, who had already been diagnosed with a brain tumor, and the military tried to send him back to Iraq anyway with a brain tumor. There was another fellow from Alaska who was already diagnosed with severe PTSD. They tried to send him back in and saying, well, we'll be able to give you some more drugs, and you can get some treatment while you're in Iraq. So this is how desperate the military has become to try to keep enough boots on the ground in both these occupations that are really continuing on into an indefinite future.
I guess you get a lot of people talking to you anonymously, Dar.
I do. I have a lot of folks talking with me anonymously. For example, right now I'm working on a story about sexual assault in the military. As I mentioned before, you know, 1 in 3 women in the military, according to the VA, are sexually assaulted at some point during their contract with the military. But what I'm also finding is that it appears as though a minimum of 1 in 10 men are also sexually assaulted while they're in the military as well.
Whoa. Let's go to Palmer. Phil joins the program. Phil, you're on Talk of Alaska with Dar Jamil.
Thank you, Steve. Dar, I'm hoping to come listen to you when you speak in Anchorage. Two questions. They're sort of related to each other. Could you, if you know enough to describe it, describe the current plight of the Christians in Iraq? And the second question would be, have you noticed in talks with serving military or veterans about their reluctance to go back to Iraq or Afghanistan, the relationship between any of that and the proselytization by fundamentalist Christians inside of our military to get people to adhere to their doctrine?
Sure thing. Both good questions. The first about the plight of Christians in Iraq. I mean, most Christians, you know, the short version of the story is most have fled. Most who could afford to in any way have gotten the heck out of the country altogether, because with the collapse of Saddam Hussein, and I'm not in any way condoning his regime, but he did keep Iraq fairly secular. So there wasn't religious fundamentalism. There certainly wasn't an Al-Qaeda presence in Iraq. And actually, Christians were fairly protected in Iraq and didn't have these problems like their churches being car bombs or them being singled out by Islamic radicals or anything like this. So with the fall of his state and the rise of fundamentalism in Iraq, which continues to this day, Christians started being deliberately targeted by not just Al-Qaeda, but other religious groups as well. And so for the most part, most of them have fled the country. There are still some there, but they continue to be there in a presence with very, very difficult and dangerous circumstances. And then regarding the situation you asked about in the U.S. military, more and more people are starting to refuse to go back to both occupations, and not so much people that haven't been to one of the occupations already, but it's actually more dissent in the ranks among veterans, where I've interviewed many people who've come out and served tours in Iraq, for example, and then come back, and then they're being stop-lost. Stop-loss is a program we still have now. It was set up under George Bush, but Obama is continuing it. About 6% of the soldiers in Iraq alone are stop-lost.
Now, wait a minute. Didn't he? I thought Obama said he was not going to do stop-loss anymore.
Well, that's another case of him saying one thing and doing another, because he certainly is continuing on with stop loss. As I said, according to the Pentagon, their most recent statistic on it, just as of a few weeks ago, is that 6% of the troops in Iraq are stop lost. And so that means when they come up to the end of their contract, the government has the right to step in and say, well, sorry, we're in an emergency situation. We need you for another deployment. So we're going to break your contract and send you back to Iraq or Afghanistan again. So I'm talking to a lot of people that are coming back. They have from a deployment to Iraq. Maybe it's their first, maybe it's their second, maybe it's their third. And then they have a few weeks left. They're about to get released, so they think. And then they're stop lost, and then they're going to be sent to Afghanistan instead. And I've talked to several people, too, most recently, a guy named Victor Augusto and then a guy named Sergeant Travis Bishop, both of them from down here in Texas from Fort Hood, who both publicly refused orders to go to Afghanistan for different reasons, but part of the reasons being, look, I saw so much corruption in Iraq, and then the work we were doing there had nothing to do with actually helping people, which is what I was led to believe when I went over, and I just don't want to be part of this system anymore. But very quickly addressing the fundamentalism in the military, there certainly was a big push by the Bush administration. I talked to many people who said, yes, we were given these little prayer books or prayer cards, and we were supposed to read one every day. Sometimes they were things like pray for your commander-in-chief and this kind of thing. There have been certainly instances instances in Iraq where people were trying to kind of convert people of Islam over to Christianity, handing out literature, handing out things of along these lines, going into mosques, desecrating mosques, spray painting crosses on the walls. So this kind of thing has happened. I don't think it's been really an overall general military possible. I haven't seen anything that would support that. But there certainly have been particular units that have kind of taken it upon themselves to try to act as missionaries while they're busy occupying the country as well.
Why have the Christians in the United States, both in and out of the military, been so reluctant to make a point of making it more public, the plight of the Christians in Iraq? Is it that the fundamentalists in the military don't believe that the Iraqi-type Christians are really Christians?
I don't think it's so much that. I think, you know, for at least from what I've seen, and I can't speak, you know, a complete answer to this because I really haven't seen anything in the military where, you know, and there could be some aspects of some folks that are genuinely concerned with, well, hey, what's happening to the Christians in Iraq? Why aren't we doing more to protect them? But, you know, if that existed, maybe it kind of fell along the lines of, well, what happened, for example, in the fall of Baghdad, where there were some people that were concerned with, hey, we have to protect these antiquities and these treasures and, you know, these things in the museums instead of just standing by and watching them be looted. So if there may have been some goodwill somewhere in the military to try to do that, maybe they just simply weren't allowed because it's not part of their mission per se, or something along those lines.
Bill, I think we have to put your question in the category of unanswerable at the moment. Thank you very much for your call, Phil from Palmer. We're talking with Dar Jamail. He is he's been in Iraq several times beyond the Green Zone, and he's now written a book about the dissent in the military, people serving in that war and not wanting to anymore, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
The calls are thundering in. You can use email at talk@APRN.org. Our guest is once again Dar Jamail. And Dar, I want to go back to this case of Specialist Augusto. But first, let's let Anna come on from Anchorage to tell us about the where you're appearing in Fairbanks. Anna, go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much for the show. I actually am in Fairbanks. And I'm helping to coordinate the Fairbanks event, so I wanted to let folks know that that will be in Scheibel Auditorium at 7 p.m. on Sunday, the 15th.
That's a pretty big venue, isn't it?
Oh, no, it's not actually that big. It's 150 or so, I think. The uh-huh. Scheibel Auditorium is one of, you know, it's in the Bunnell Building on campus. But no, it's not particularly big. But I think we'll probably have a pretty good showing. So oh,
yeah, give me the date and time again.
Sunday, the 15th at 7 p.m.
Yeah, we're coming right up on it. All right. Thank you very much. Anything else you want to add, Anna?
Yeah, I do. I just wanted to confirm that this is an indeed incredibly fascinating book. There are a lot of really long and very articulate quotes from some of the soldiers that really describe the details of their methods of subversion, if you will, and their ways of protecting themselves and a lot of times their buddies from the craziness that they're seeing. And I think one of the most important connections or one of the most interesting things to me was the way that Dar's empathy for the civilian PTSD and then his own experience of PTSD bridged him to the GIs, who are, of course, going through that same thing. And that seems to be a pretty important common denominator. And so I just thought I'd mention that, and it is a fascinating read. So thank you for the show, and thank you, Dar, for your work.
All right, Anna, thank you very much for that. And yeah, I have to echo this about empathy, Dar. I think one thing that marks your reporting, I'm always thinking about the poor doctors in Fallujah, and you're writing about how desperate that situation was there. You really do seem to be very, very much of a sympathetic writer. You want to write about people.
That's, you know, to me, that's what journalism is. I mean, I think it's bringing the stories of human beings, you know, whether it be what's happening in Iraq or Afghanistan or in the military or in New Orleans in the wake of Katrina or whatever it might be, but bringing these stories back to other human beings. I think it's all about humanizing the situation. And for me, writing about war, you know, this whole idea of quote-unquote objective journalism, I think is a total farce. I mean, the second, for example, we decide what language to report in, well, there goes our objectivity, or what outlet we're going to try to write for, well, there goes our objectivity, or when we choose what story to report versus, you know, choosing, you know, for example, choosing one and not choosing another, well, then we've lost our objectivity right there. So, you know, the whole idea that you can report or should report, you know, objectively is an outdated scenario that came about with the corporatization of journalism as a whole in the United States back in the 1930s.
Yeah, in some ways, it really I track it really back to Murrow and the rise of CBS after the Second World War. In a lot of ways, it journalism got on a kind of a pedestal as a result of that. So it was really another war. But yeah, I will have to say, you know, personally, as a news consumer, I really like the reports of embedded journalists. It doesn't bother me that they're embedded. They say they're embedded. That's fine. They're telling what they see.
Right, and that's one side of the story, and I'm simply reporting on another side of the story, and I reported on Embedded for the first book that I wrote, which was specifically about how the occupation is affecting the Iraqi people, and now I'm reporting on Embedded from within the military, where I'm actually going in and talking to the rank and file and people that served over there and continuing to do so, and reporting the stories that we're not hearing. So instead of reporting, you know, like on the flag waving, oh yes, this is working great, and we're turning another corner in Iraq or Afghanistan, I'm reporting on, well, this is what it's actually costing people in the military. And so when we hear these horror stories of people not getting the help they need from the VA, or people being sent over for repeated deployments, people being diagnosed with severe PTSD and being sent back out for the front lines, how are these people really being affected? And then what happens to their families? I mean, some of the stories of what I've been coming across of what's happening to people in the military and where are they going to get these troops are absolutely shocking. I mean, just really, really unbelievable. So when we have a military that really, in so many instances, I'm seeing many, many examples of them being really, really unwilling to even try to take care of their own people, their own soldiers properly. Well, it doesn't take a genius to see. Well, at some point, we're going to start to see some breakdown, and we're going to start to see some descent in the ranks.
So then here you have your specialist Agosto down there in Texas. I mean, what has pushed him to this? It seems that, I mean, it's so hopeless, because where are you going to go? You're going to go to a court-martial. Who's going to judge you in a court-martial? Well, it's going to be a court-martial. You're not under the jurisdiction of the U.S. court system. It just seems like he really got himself out on a limb, and now a bunch of others are too.
Right. Specialist Augusto, this is a guy who served a tour in Iraq. He was coming to the end of his 4-year contract in the Army. What he saw in Iraq turned him against the occupations. He said, look, this is... I saw nothing but rampant corporate corruption. I saw contractors making obscene amounts of money. I mean, he saw firsthand the things that we've been talking about and hearing about for years now. And so he came back and he said, look, it was horrible. We were there to do nothing good, but he decided he was going to just wait and just get the heck out of the military because he only had about a month left on his contract. And then he was stop lost, and they said, sorry, you start packing your bags, you're going to get ready to go to Afghanistan. And he realized then, no, this whole system is completely corrupted. It's all about global domination. Neither of these occupations are about helping people, let alone bringing more security to people back in the United States. So I'm not going to be a part of it. And so he stood up and said, I refuse to go, and knowing that he was going to get court-martialed. And, you know, this is a military court, as you mentioned correctly, Steve, because I actually sat in on one of these court-martials last summer. It's a total kangaroo court. It's run by the military. They already know what the verdict is going in. And he basically was, however, just given a month in a county jail and then discharged from the military. So he actually received a surprisingly light sentence for doing a public refusal to deploy to Afghanistan. And now is already out. He's out of the military, and now he's doing active work to help other GI resistors.
We're talking with Dar Jamail. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. Very unembedded, Mr. Jamail is. 550-8422, a local call in Anchorage. Email is talk at aprn.org. Dar, you say that you realized you had your own post-traumatic stress. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
That's right. I went over to Iraq kind of thinking, as many journalists do, well, I can't get PTSD because I'm not, you know, in combat. I'm not killing people. I'm not wading through dead bodies, this kind of thing. But what I learned is after I basically did four consecutive trips in and out of Iraq, and last time I spoke with you, it was in between a couple of those, and, you know, literally going into morgues and seeing bodies and seeing people die in Fallujah and seeing bombs dropped in cities. And I then had to kind of learn after the fact that, no, you can get PTSD even seeing this stuff from afar or kind of after the fact. It's called secondary trauma. And, of course, a lot of mine was primary because I was shot at times and had car bombs go off nearby my hotel and that kind of thing. So very much was traumatized and came back to the States. And basically after burning my personal life to the ground and realizing that I could feel nothing other than either total numbness or complete rage, there was basically no other emotion I was capable of feeling, I actually had a Vietnam vet friend of mine pull me aside and said, hey, Bubs, you should talk to somebody about this. And so I realized I needed to take care of myself, and actually a good friend of mine, John there in Anchorage, also pulled me aside and said, look, you either need to figure out how to do this the right way, or you're going to need to walk away from this work, Bubs, because you're a bit of a mess. And so I learned that I had to get some counseling and talk to someone, just like all these other vets have to do when they come back home. You have to talk to somebody about it, because post-traumatic stress disorder, you cannot go into one of these occupations and really, really see what's happening on the ground and not come back unaffected. You will have PTSD when you come back from Iraq or Afghanistan. If you go out, and even for a week, and they're out on the streets amongst people. So it's a crisis situation in that we look at the number of vets now that have cycled through both these occupations. It's over 2 million now, and they come back home, and they're going to need this type of treatment, and that's going to take a long time, and it's something that even once you get treatment, the nightmares and such might go away, and the rage and that kind of thing will go away, but you still then have PTSD for the rest of your life and have to kind of negotiate and deal with that properly. But yeah,
you know, Dar, we're gonna need volunteers. I can see some of the NAM guys getting involved in this, and certainly Desert Storm guys and women getting involved in, you know, volunteering to be part of this massive counseling that's going to be needed.
It's absolutely going to be needed on a scale, and this is why the VA can't keep up. I mean, we just passed the point, and again, not just from veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan, but veterans of all wars. Just a couple of months ago, the VA crossed over a line of having 1 million people who had filed disability claims with the VA. So they are, to say they're overtaxed is putting it very, very mildly. And so it is. I'm running into some of these organizations around the country where veterans themselves are setting up their own organizations to try to help their own. Different NGOs are being set up, nonprofits, different kind of, you know, there are psychologists and psychiatrists around the country who are volunteering to do pro bono work with veterans because the system just cannot keep up with the number of traumatized people coming home that need help.
You know, it's so funny. My dad told me this about World War II, and for all I know, he got it from the Civil War people. You know, it's like every combat situation, when the veterans come home, they have to fight for their benefits. I mean, he did even after World War II. They generally thought to have been treated fairly generously, not by his lights.
Right. You know, and it's really a stunning situation where even today, you know, this trend of obviously, given the nature of the talk today, it's continuing on. Because we look at a situation, for example, like recently there's a story that I covered. There's a guy named Leo Church. He's actually in the brig right now. He's in a military jail up at Fort Lewis in Washington State. And this is a guy who his situation was such that he was in the military, not being paid very much money, as most folks in the military aren't. And his wife and two kids were having to live in a car because they literally could not make rent just living off his pay alone. So he approached his commander and said, "Look, I've got a crisis situation here. I need to do something to resolve it." And they wouldn't help him out, and so he brought his wife and kids up to Fort Hood, where he was in Texas, and then he was punished for doing so, and ended up going AWOL to try to figure out a way to deal with his family, and then, of course, came back and turned himself back in and said, "Look, I had to go AWOL to try to take care of my wife and kids because you guys wouldn't try to help me out in any way." And so they court-martialed him, and now he's in the brig, and the situation is such that his wife was pregnant at the time, and they had to give their third child up for adoption because they didn't have any money. And so if that's how the military is treating its own, people that are enlisted, not even discharged yet, you can imagine the stage that's set for folks that then actually get discharged and then are trying to get help through the VA.
Dave in Juneau, you're on the air with Dar Jamil. Dave, you still with us? Line one, Dave? Okay, that's fine. Let's go ahead and take our break now, Gooseberry. Can we do that as Talk of Alaska continues?
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Alaska Communication Systems. ACS offers high-capacity, high-speed bandwidth for business with speeds up to Gig E, connecting companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
It's Dar Jamil with us. He'll be in Alaska later on this month. He'll be speaking in Anchorage, Juneau, and as we heard, Fairbanks. And Dar, I think next we'll go to Roger in White Mountain. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Roger.
Good morning, Talk Alaska personnel, online listeners, and people listening to this broadcast. Thanks for taking my call. We hear about American casualties due to roadside bombings, etc. But what I'm interested in is, what about casualties to the terrorists? Are they higher than the American casualties? I'll hang up and listen to your response. Thank you.
Thank you, Roger, and thanks for calling from White Mountain. Dar, can anybody really answer that?
I don't think so. The military made it very, very clear, for example, at the beginning of both wars, that they weren't going to try to keep casualty counts on the other side. Regarding resistance fighters in either Iraq or Afghanistan, we don't have any really any numbers whatsoever. We do have, while we don't have any civilian casualty estimates in Afghanistan and Iraq, we have two different groups. One in the U.S., a group called Just Foreign Policy, that's been keeping a number, and a similar number by a group over in Oxford, England.
Right.
And both groups estimate the number of Iraqis that have been killed since 2003 to be between 1.2 and 1.4 million.
Yeah, but as far as who's a terrorist and who's not, boy, that's awfully subjective.
Indeed it is.
Let's go to Patrick, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Patrick.
Thank you, Steve, and thank you, Mr. Jamar, for Mr. Mayo, for being on the show. This is a wonderful program. First, the caller just before this one kind of answered my question, but can you say, Adar, that the vast majority of deaths caused in a confrontation in Iraq are caused by Iraqis killing Iraqis? Can you say that? And then after that, one quick question after that.
Well, there's, again, I think there's a study that came out called the Lancet Survey, which many people probably heard of because it was a controversially high number back in October 2006 that estimated at the time 655,000 deaths as a direct result of the invasion and occupation. And they estimated that approximately 90% of those deaths were violent deaths. But I don't think, and I could be wrong on this, but I don't remember them really trying to differentiate where were they killed by Iraqi on Iraqi violence, or was it Iraqis killed by occupation forces? I didn't really see anything that differentiated where the majority fell on, whether they were killed by Iraqis or by occupation forces.
Patrick,
and one more quick one.
Yes.
Are there any enforceable gun laws in Iraq?
Is that a joke? There's your answer. Absolutely not. No. Well, one thing, just what people may not know is that even according to the military, every house in Iraq is allowed to have at least one Kalashnikov, one AK-47, because the security there, even to this day, is so bad that even the military said, look, people need to have a way to defend their homes from bandits, from looters, from what have you. So every house is allowed at least one Kalashnikov. So that would be, I guess, kind of the Iraqi version of gun control.
Thank you. Thank you for your call, Patrick. Yeah, Dar, did you ever get anywhere near getting kidnapped?
I did. I had a couple of close calls. I had one instance where me and another journalist and our driver were actually chased by a car on the outskirts of Fallujah, but we actually fortunately had basically a faster car, so we were able to get away. There was another instance where me and my main interpreter, through most of my Iraq trips, a guy named Harp, we were actually in Fallujah and were detained for a time by some Mujahideen. This was between the April 2004 siege and the November 2004 siege. We'd gone back in May to kind of report on what was happening in Fallujah in the wake of that first siege. And we were interviewing some Iraqi military in the town, and they were actually all under the orders of the Mujahideen, because people in the town, most people wanted the Mujahideen to be in charge. They didn't want any occupying forces in their town. And so the Mujahideen, we were interviewing some of these folks, and they actually technically detained us. So I don't think I'd go so far as to call it a kidnapping, but we were actually detained by them and brought in and questioned and I guess you could say technically interrogated, but they basically just asked us some questions. And then we were fortunately very lucky, because while we were being questioned, a Mujahideen walked in, one of the resistance fighters, who was a guy who was actually a guard at a clinic, and it happened to be the same clinic that I arrived at when I came into the siege to report, where I was on the bus carrying humanitarian supplies. And so because of that coincidence, he ended up vouching for the fact that I was who I said I was, and they ended up letting us go.
He's a good guy. I saw him carrying Rick Cross box. That's Rich.
Right.
That's Rich, Dar. Rich. Let's go to John. joins the program from Fairbanks. Welcome to Talk Alaska, John.
Yeah, thanks a lot for taking my call. I had kind of a question in regards to all these mercenary groups that are in Iraq. I just finished this book called Blackwater, which brings out a lot of that information. And a lot of those different groups are being supported by these right-wing evangelical groups. And I'm just wondering how much that affects the people over there, knowing that, you know, is that giving them the thought that we're trying to disrupt or destroy their religion over there?
That is a fantastic observation, John, and probably several shows could be built on that one. Let's get Dar's observation of that. We were talking before the show, as a matter of fact, about how much the savagery of the attack on Fallujah might have had something to do with the way those Blackwater people were dismembered?
Well, it does. First of all, the mercenary groups in Iraq, Blackwater, of course, being a preeminent example, but just one example of many. There's over 50 different mercenary groups operating in Iraq, and some people call them security companies or private security, but I think the most accurate term to describe them is mercenaries, because they're literally guns for hire, these people. So Blackwater, of course, being a good example in that their leader, Eric Prince, the guy CEO, he now stepped down in the midst of all this controversy, but still, of course, maintains ties to the company that he founded, is a radical Christian fundamentalist. And, of course, there was an article that came out in The Nation magazine just a few months ago quoting a couple of his employees, a couple of former Blackwater employees, saying, yes, we heard this guy, Eric Prince is his name, say that we want to go over to Iraq as a mercenary company and basically kill as many Muslims as we can. That his goal personally was to eradicate Islam from the face of the earth. So very, very clear what their agenda is, literally a crusade. And so this, of course, when we see this played out on the ground in Iraq, and you try to convince Iraqis that this is not a war that has anything to do with religion or trying to afflict them with Christianity or turn them into some religion that they don't want to be a part of or anything like this, it becomes hard to do that when you have some soldiers in the military trying to do that, and then you have basically a radical fundamentalist ideology group as the leader of Blackwater was. Not to say every person working for Blackwater would fit this description, that would not be accurate, but when you have the leadership with that type of agenda, that's only going to make things much, much worse on the ground. And so I think this is yet another layer of you see a conflict between mercenary companies and the military at large, because the military, for example, has to follow things like the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and they theoretically at least have to abide by international law and the U.S. Constitution when they're abroad. And yet these mercenary companies, there's no accountability. So if they want to try to spread Christianity or kill people and walk away from it and not face any kind of court-martial or anything like that, then they can do that, and that's why we see these horrible things that we've seen Blackwater do in Iraq. That's why they're quite rampant.
All right. Thank you very much, John. That was sort of a softball question, but thank you just the same. I think it's stuff we just have to be looking at. Kevin from Chugiak, you're our last caller.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for doing this program. I wanted to give a heads up to your viewers again, or to your listeners, that Dar is also going to be appearing in Anchorage on Monday, November 16th, in the Social Sciences Building at the University, room 118, at 7 o'clock in the evening. And
all right.
So Anchorage listeners can hear more from Dar at that time.
All right.
And I thought I would just also throw in my 2 cents worth.
Quickly.
The military is a very, very blunt instrument. It can kill people, it can destroy things, but it can't make people get along with each other. It can't make people like us. And its use should be very, very limited.
All right. Thank you, Kevin. Dar Jamil, I want to thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you again, Steve, very much.
Yeah, Dar Jamil on book tour now for The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. His previous book is out in paperback now, Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. Fascinating reading. You meet some very, very interesting people. And by the way, his translator, Mr. Harb, has made it to Damascus, and his family is safe. Gooseberry Peter on the controls, Pat Yak on the phones today. Next week, at what point do we start teaching our children what? Thanks for listening. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by TelAlaska, a telecommunications company proud to support public broadcasting, sharing the spirit of communications across the Great Land. Voice data and Wi-Fi technologies at TelAlaska, on the web at telalaska.com. And by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.